Translation. A part of the Purush lies down within the water of the universe. From the navel lake of his body sprouts a lotus stem, and from the lotus flower atop this stem, Brahma, the master of all engineers in the universe, becomes manifested. Purport. Let's have a look. It's quite a long one. Anyway, we'll liven it up for you. The first Purusha is the Karanadakshai Vishnu. From his skin holes, innumerable universes have sprung up. In each and every universe, the Purusha enters as the Garbhadakshai Vishnu. He's lying within the half of the universe, which is full with the water of his body. And from the navel of Garbhadakshai Vishnu has sprung the stem of the lotus flower, the birthplace of Brahma, who is the father of all living beings and the master of all the demigod engineers engaged in the perfect design and working of the universal order. Within the stem of the lotus, there are 14 divisions of planetary systems, and the earthly planets are situated in the middle. Upwards, there are other, better planetary systems, and the topmost system is called Brahmaloka or Satyaloka. Downwards from the earthly planetary system, there are 7 lower planetary systems inhabited by the Asuras and similar other materialistic beings. From Garbhadakshai Vishnu, there is the expansion of the Kshirirodakshai Vishnu, who is the collective Paramatma of all living beings. He's called Hari, and from him all incarnations within the universe are expanded. Therefore, the conclusion is that the Purusha avatar is manifested in 3 features. First, the Karanadakshai, who creates aggregate material ingredients in the Mat-Tattva. Second, the Garbhadakshai, who enters in each and every universe. And third, the Kshirirodakshai Vishnu, who is the Paramatma of every material object, organic or inorganic. One who knows these plenary features of the Supreme Personality of Godhead knows Godhead properly, and thus the knower becomes freed from the material conditions of birth, death, old age, and disease, as it is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita. In this sloka, the subject matter of Mahavishnu is summarized. Mahavishnu lies down in some part of the spiritual sky by his own free will. Thus he lies on the ocean of Karana, where he glances over his material nature, and the Mat-Tattva is at once created. Thus electrified by the power of the Lord, the material nature at once creates innumerable universes, just as in due course a tree decorates itself with innumerable grown fruits. The seed of the tree is sown by the cultivator, and the tree or creeper in due course becomes manifest with so many fruits. Nothing can take place without a cause. The Karana ocean is therefore called the causal ocean, because Karana means causal. We should not foolishly accept the atheistic theory of creation. The description of the atheist is given in the Bhagavad Gita. The atheist does not believe in the creator, but he cannot give a good theory to explain the creation. Material nature has no power to create without the power of the Purusha, just as a Prakriti, or a woman, cannot produce a child without the connection of a Purusha, a man. The Purusha impregnates and the Prakriti delivers. We should not expect milk from the fleshy bags on the neck of a goat, although they may look like breastling nipples. Similarly, we should not expect any creative power from the material ingredients. We must believe in the power of the Purusha who impregnates Prakriti, or nature. Because the Lord wished to lie down in meditation, the material energy created innumerable universes at once. In each of them, the Lord lay down, and thus all the planets and the different paraphernalia were created by the will of the Lord. The Lord has unlimited potencies, and thus he can act as he likes by perfect planning. Although personally he has nothing to do, no one is greater than or equal to him. That is the verdict of the Vedas. Om Gyanam Tiridam Dasha Jalangara Shalakaya Daksha Om Minitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurve Namaha. Sri Chaitanya Manobhistam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Garamayam Tadati Svapatantikam Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasaya Bhutale Shrimati Bhaktivedanta Swamini Tinamine Namaste Sasvati Devi Guravani Pracharine Nivasesha Shunyavadi Prashachade Satadine Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sivasari Gura Bhaktivinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So it's made very, very clear here about the origin of this material manifest universe. And Prabhupada actually basically says the atheistic theories, the idea that this universe has come around by chance, or for some quantum theory, quantum mechanical arrangement, is basically more or less bogus. And in fact, they will believe anything. They'll even believe in many, many millions of accidental universes rather than to believe in the creator of one. It's almost like the, from some people's point of view, the belief in a creator or an origin, an intelligence origin of the universe, is the absolute last resort. They'll believe in anything else apart from God. It doesn't matter what it is. It doesn't matter how extreme that theory might be. They will opt for that. But the idea of believing in a personal God, a form, a spiritual form, as being the origin of this material manifestation is abhorrent to the atheistic point of view. However, as devotees, we find it very, very easy to accept. We can just see, just for example, Radha Govinda Prabhu here, he goes and he gets a piece of paper and he sees, oh, this is a nice song, I think I'll photocopy that. So he takes it to the photocopy, and out comes a photocopy of the original. However, the original is never, the copy is never as the same as the original. So this material world is simply, the form that we experience in this world is simply a reflection, a mirror image, if you like, of the original form of the spiritual world. So form that we experience does not come from formlessness. It does not come from simply a white formless light. If that were the case, then this universe would have some sense of superiority over the spiritual world. We have form, we have relationships, we have feelings, we have love, or so-called love often. We have, and so you're saying the spiritual world doesn't have these things? No, it's the other way around. That we, the experience and the form and the relationships we experience are actually present in their original form in the spiritual world. So of course that's one of my favourite paintings. You can just see there, just by the bell on the wall, the huge ball of this lotus flower, and in there of course is Goloka Vrindavan. Lord Krishna's pastimes and Lord Chaitanya's pastimes are happening eternally there, and that is the norm in terms of time and space are not experienced in the same way as we experience. But from that planet, that original planet, innumerable Vaikuntha planets are also emanating in the spiritual sky, where of course, as we know, the many, many different avatars and forms of the Lord, but worshipped in the sense of awe and reverence. And of course, in one corner of that spiritual sky, as quite nicely, I think, depicted in that painting, that's why I picked on the painting, of course, is the Mahatattva, this material cosmic manifestation. But it's only no more than 25% of the population of everything is within the Mahatattva. The Nitya Siddhas, the eternal liberated souls, never enter into the material world. However, the Nitya Buddhas, that's us, we do. It's not that we just choose to serve Krishna in a different way. That's often been described. Why would we fall out of love with Krishna? Why would we foolishly come to this material world? Is it curiosity? Is it ego? Is it the idea, the will? Ego can be characterized and described as being the will to put oneself at the center rather than Krishna. And this is actually the basis of the material world, is our ego, as we will find out in a minute. I'll get into that. Because Mahavishnu, he enters into his half in meditation, his eyes are actually like this, you know, half open, like this, and he's lying down, and he glances at Prakriti, the material nature, the Pradhan, which is the unmanifest material nature, before the universe is created. The personification of this is Durga Maa, the goddess, the great goddess. She's the Prakriti, you could say, the Mother Nature. So he glances at Mother Nature. That glance itself includes all the conditioned souls, that's us, motivated by ego. And when that chemical reaction, if you like, between the material nature and the conditioned souls, the our ego, suddenly this is the beginning of the creation of the universe as we know it. It's like a chemical combination on a subtle level. And I'll get into that in just a second, because I've made a note of that. Yes, here we are. So this is what it is. For example, we know, scientists will go into a laboratory, gets two chemicals together and forms an explosion or forms something else. So similarly, we have this chemical combination between the unmanifest material potential nature, and then when Mahavishnu glances at this, then it sets the universe in motion, as it were. Before that, there may be the Mahatattva, but that is just a cloud in the corner of the spiritual sky. It's just potential. And yet, when you put the jivas into it, the Nityabhadas enter into that through the glance of Mahavishnu, and through our karmas and deserve and what we desire, the universe manifests. And this is very interesting, actually, because Prabhupada was talking in his purport about the atheistic view versus the theistic view. And this is quite interesting, because I was looking at some of the studies of devotees like Sadaputta Das and other devotees, drawing on interesting similarities between the creation of the universe and, for example, the mundane explanation, the Big Bang and so forth, you know, the scientific explanation, and the explanation in the Bhagavatam. And what's striking is not only the differences, as we've described, but the similarities as well. And that's really something I wanted to get into. I'll give you an example. In the Srimad Bhagavatam cantos 3, 2 and 12, this is where I'm getting the source from, Pradhan is described as unmanifest form of matter. No manifestation or gross or subtle element. It's without space, it is without time, it's yet to be injected with the jivas. Interesting singularity in mundane science is also described as no formation of matter or space. Then in the Bhagavatam, the undifferentiated yet total material elements are contained therein, void and no space. Very, very similar concept in modern science as well. And yet, then we understand in the Bhagavatam, cantos 3 and 2, time is then injected into the Pradhana. It is agitated and begins to manifest, thus creation begins. And the cause of that is time is injected by the glance of Mahavishnu. And by the glance of the Lord also injects souls with their respective karma. And we actually just already described that. And this is the interesting thing, because at this point, once this goes on, the formation of the layers of the universe begins to manifest. So there's a sense of condensation, if you like, of more subtle elements through into more gross elements, to the point where we recognize the universe as it is today, where we have water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence and ego. But there's one point in the history of the universe when these things weren't there. It was just ego. It was just pure ego that we provided. So for the false ego, the first of the five elements, sky, is created. And because the sky is transformed, then air is generated. So again, we're talking now about the formation of the universe. In mundane science, it describes as space expands, the universe cools down, enabling formation of fundamental particles. Due to gravity, these elements clusters together, forming gas clouds. Interesting. Bhagavatam says, when the air is transformed, in the course of time and nature's course, fire is generated. So again, we're homing in now on the next layer of the universe. Interestingly enough, mundane science reads, as the gas clouds become denser, gravitational collapse causes formation of stars, creating light and heat. Bhagavatam says, since fire is also transformed, there is also the manifestation then of water. Mundane science describes that when the star dies, it explodes, and this releases a chemical combination where water is produced. And hence, the innermost layer of the universe, of course, is when Earth becomes manifest from water. And again, a very, very similar concept, I suppose, where water becomes for the Earth. And there's some planets in the universe, including, of course, the Earth, where you have all these elements together. So from a Vedic point of view, the earth is at the center, where you've got, we have a combination of earth, water, fire, air, and so forth. These are the famous elements. So within this inner core of the universe, so what we're dealing with now, we're dealing with the inner core of the universe, which includes all the combination of all these different elements. And this inner universe is only about 4 billion miles across, which in cosmic terms is absolutely tiny. But when you consider they've got to add all the layers as well, layer of Earth, which would be 10 times 4 billion, which is 40 billion, and then 10 times that, of course, is the layer of water, 10 times that, the layer of fire, 10 times that layer of air, 10 times, 10 times, until you get to the huge layer of ego. And at that point, of course, it's very, very large indeed. So so even that kind of degree of size is also compatible with modern science, interestingly enough. So we were saying in the purple, weren't we, that out of God, in each and every universe, God, actually, Vishnu is there. And then out of his navel, of course, sprouts the lotus stem. And at the top of the lotus stem, of course, the lotus flower is Lord Brahma, the grandfather, as said here, or the father, the creator, the architect of all the entities in the universe. So this is interesting as well, because he's the creator. Lord Brahma is the creator, but he's not God. He's working on behalf of God. He's like a secretary, or he's kind of there, he's in God's company. But he's not actually, but God himself, he's not actually doing the hard work. He's enjoying, because he's God, he can do that. But Lord Brahma himself, although of course far, far more advanced and elevated than intelligent than us, nevertheless, compared with Krishna, he's insignificant. And we learn about that in Krishna Leela, when Lord Brahma hides the cowherd boys away, but Krishna simply replaces them with more cowherd boys. Then Lord Brahma realizes his place, and then realizes, wow, this is more than just a blue boy living in the forest, looking after cows. This is more than a demigod. This is the supreme personality of Godhead. So then, of course, he pays his obeisances with his foreheads to Krishna's feet. And then what happens? Other Lord Brahmas from other universes also come and pay their obeisances. And many of them are much, much larger Lord Brahmas as well. So I think at that point, Lord Brahma saw things into perspective. So what to speak of ourselves, motivated in our conditioned state, as I mentioned before, by our ego, which is the building block of all karma in this universe, ultimately, the origin. And yet this ego we have is so fundamental to our sense of self-identity. It's very, very difficult to overcome. It's very difficult to overcome the universe, our condition, because we've had it, we've carried it around for so many millions of lifetimes. And it's only now, perhaps in this lifetime, at least, or, you know, not many lifetimes anyway, where we've actually become conversant and familiar with this philosophy. Or perhaps we're trying to, anyway, in my case, trying to understand it. And we realize that sense of ego is absolutely fundamental to us, to the point where we're confronted with it. We have some very, very important questions to ask ourselves, and we realize how conditioned we really are. Even Lord Brahma fell at Krishna's feet, so why should we not fall at Krishna's feet? And what are we compared with the demigods? What are we compared with Lord Brahma? We are absolutely insignificant. When you think about time and space from Lord Brahma's point of view, we were talking, weren't we, about the origin of the universe and the formation of the earth and the universe. And, you know, we're talking about the universe at the moment being something in the region of 155 trillion years old, according to earthly calculation. If you do your maths and add up all those figures, you come to that. Lord Brahma, he just feels he's like 50, 51 years old according to his own experience. That's what it feels like to him. But calculated on the earth, by earthly level, that would be a very, very long. So how significant are we? The most famous people, perhaps in earth's history, mundane history, Julius Caesar, or I don't know, Donald Trump, who knows. But how significant are they and their egos? How long will it last from the point of view of Lord Brahma? from the point of view of Lord Brahma, 1 second, if you do your maths, you can just do this. I've done it, by the way, before I came. 1 second to Lord Brahma, according to the scale I mentioned, would be about 7,500 years, according to earthly scale. 1 second. It's like that. So how big are we? How big are we? And if, I think it's helpful to meditate on our insignificance when compared with Lord Krishna and Lord Vishnu, the Creator. Because how can our egos compete with that? We cannot compete with Krishna. We can never be Krishna. We have no chance. And yet, when we're motivated by ego, there is that sense of, maybe I am God after all. Or maybe at least there isn't a personal God, and at least I can merge into the personal Brahman and become one with God. This is also motivated by ego. I can become one with God. There isn't actually, God doesn't actually have a form. It's just a light, and if I'm non-different from that light, therefore I can become God after all. But this is actually the last snare of Maya. As soon as we understand and we believe and we meditate on the fact that the Lord, Supreme Personality of Godhead, has a form, that's a big step, actually, when you think about it from a philosophical point of view. There's a huge step from believing in an impersonal Brahman only to there being a personality. Thus, we even see Goloka Vrindavan there. It's surrounded, actually, by the Brahma-jyoti effulgence. But to get into that lotus flower, to get into that place of variety and form of bliss, is not to be taken for granted. It cannot be done, it cannot be achieved without bhakti, actually. And that's not a small thing, that's not a trivial thing. So, of course, time for Lord Brahma is experienced very differently to as we experience, but his creation, he's the grandfather, or the great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather, actually. He has his immediate children who occupy heavenly planets and the universe. And this is something, of course, touched on in the purport. He's not alone. He lives in Satyaloka, or Brahmaloka, Brahma's planet, where all the people live practically as long as Lord Brahma and live in very, very heavenly. In fact, we cannot conceive of what they experience. But there are other planets as well, created different levels, 14 planetary divisions, as Prabhupada writes, or sometimes they're called planetary systems, and they're stacked vertically, not physically, but it's a vertical stacking, where the highest one is Brahma Loka in this universe, and you go down, 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 till you get to lowering levels of consciousness, and also time is experienced differently as well, the lower you go. For example, underneath Satyaloka is Tapaloka. This is where the four Kumaras come from. Tapa, austerity, so people, great yogis that have formed, perform great austerities may be rewarded by taking birth on this heavenly planet of Tapaloka. Janaloka is the reward, again a beautiful planet, of those performing celibacy and other aspects of austerity there. Underneath that, Mahaloka. So each planet as goes by is not quite as divine as the previous, but it's far superior to that of the Earth. Mahaloka is a great place where great rishis live. Great rishis live, and where meditation and spiritual activity is very conducive. Below Mahaloka is Bhuvaloka. Again, so we're getting closer to the Earth now. Again, not talking about physical, but in terms of the consciousness of the entities there. On the planets known as Bhuvaloka, this is the realms of the upper devas, the Gandharvas, and the advanced humans. And then and only then do we get to the Earth level, Bhuloka. That's the Earth-like planets. It's not the only Earth-like planet in the universe, but we are, in Vedic cosmology, the Earth is very much in the central position of the universe. But then that's not just that. This Prabhupada describes there's lesser planets as well. There's lower planetary systems that are spiritually inferior to that of the Earth, from the point of view of consciousness. So they may be more materially advanced, the Asuras. They may, and in fact, they are much more materially advanced. But from their spiritual consciousness point of view, they're worse than the earth. They're actually at a disadvantage from the point of view of spiritual life because their possibility for enjoyment is so much greater than ours, or at least some of them, until you get to the hellish planets, and I'll get into that. that's worse, really bad. But they have the lower planets, some of them have Asuric beings. They're atheistic, but through their manipulation of the material energy and science, they've conquered disease. They think they've conquered death, although everything is temporary, and so forth. So thus they become atheistic and materialistic. Atala, which is understood to be just the next level below the earth, is a place where men can enjoy beautiful women, which is of course very, and they drink very intoxicating things, and they think they're God, and they don't care about anything else apart from their own enjoyment. Underneath Atala is Vitala. Vitala is a place where I've noticed there's people a lot more interested now. So, it's amazing, you know, the rishis, yeah. But when it comes to like the, So Vitala is a place where everyone's wearing gold, everyone's very opulent. They live in great golden palaces, and there's gardens, and there's no disease. And they've discovered like vast realms of gold. And gold for them is just like paper would be for us, it's very common. But that's how wealthy they are. Underneath Vitala is the realm of Sutala. That's actually, the king of Sutala is actually Bali Maharaj. And he actually had a pious, he used to rule the universe. The Asuric races actually used to control the heavenly realms. We know this from various Leela. But Bali had that pious side. He saw Vamanadeva, the dwarf incarnation. He said, okay, you're a Brahmin. I respect the Brahmanas. But of course, Vamanadeva took three steps. His third step, of course, he said, whatever you steps you cross, you can own. So Lord Vamanadeva, of course, steps across the entire universe. And therefore, Bali is forced to give up his leadership of the universe. However, he had a pious side, although he was of demoniac lineage. But he was living in the realm of Sutala. He still lives there now. Again, a place of great opulence where he is living his karma. Underneath Sutala is Talatala. This is the abode of, or the origin of Mayadhanava, the greatest architect of the materialistic architect. Vishvakarma is architect of the demigods. Mayadhanava is architect of the demons. So of course, all the demonic creations, some of the Vimanas, the flying machines and the great buildings, great cities, and so forth, are designed, it's understood, by Mayadhanava. And again, their way of life is so much superior from a materialistic point of view than ours. Underneath Mahatala is Rasatala. Now it starts to get a bit nasty, you know, even from a material point of view. So the people there, they live in holes like rats. They live in dark places, dark caves. And they're enemies of the demigods, and understood to be descendants, I believe, of Hiranyakashipu. And then Patala, these are the Nagas, the snake people, and they are understood to be heartless and cruel, and basically you don't want to go there. Not very nice. Again, dark. All these subterranean planets we've mentioned are not lit up by the sun, but are actually, their actual condition is perpetual darkness, so they have to light it up themselves. Underneath Patala, just above the Garbhodaka ocean, of course, is the hellish planets. Now, the Bhagavatam describes a number of hellish planets, their rewards and their punishments. Lovely it is. Not. I think it's about 14. They give about 14 examples in the fifth canto, isn't it? But actually, there are many more than that, because karma is complicated, and there's many, many different ways to sin, so to speak. However, without going into the gory details, the main purport we can learn is not to go there, basically. But the punishment fixed the crime. For example, if someone wants to, and of course the crimes are worse for those who should know better. And this is an interesting point. If someone is from a Brahmin training, Brahmin background, but they are doing some of the sins, if you like, or some of the crimes committed, their punishment is quite direct, actually. So there, so it's not very nice at all, really. And throughout all these 14 planetary systems, there are 400,000 different types of human-like species as well. And so it's quite a large universe. And yet that is just one universe out of many, many trillions in the cosmic manifestation. So our karma, if our karma is to go to another universe, in another human type of planet or human species, then that's exactly what we'll do. There's so much variety, there's so much choice that we have here. Because our desires that we bring with us from the spiritual world into this material world is so variegated. So Krishna is so kind that he provides opportunities for us to fill our desires until we're fed up. From the highest planet to the very lowest planet, or to the earthly planets, when we realize that this is just like going around in circles, quite literally from the point of view in reincarnation, we're just fed up, we'll learn our lesson, and we'll go back home, back to Godhead, and become free from this cycle of samsara. So Lord Chaitanya, the whole lineage, Srila Prabhupada, and so forth, are given this opportunity to actually become genuinely free from the cycle of birth and death, and not even to be distracted by the pleasures of the heavenly planets or the subterranean planets, if you're so inclined, but rather to become free from, to go to the abode that is beyond the Mattattva, beyond the realm of Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva, and in fact even beyond Vaikuntha planets, beyond where the Lord is conceived in awe and reverence, to enter into, of course, the original planet of Goloka Vrindavan. That is what the Gaudiya Vaishnava aim is, actually, is to not only enter into the spiritual sky, but actually enter into the center of the original planet, Goloka Vrindavan. Like that. Now, I want to end on that particular note. However, Nishkinshana Prabhu did mention to me today, it's a very, very special day, for many reasons, not because of me being here, but there's many, many different things happening today, and I've only listed three of them. So I'll speak briefly on those three. There's more than that, actually, so I apologize for that. But, for example, one of the courses is the appearance day of Raghunath Das Goswami. It's also the disappearance day of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Yeah? And also, it's Vaishnava Panchami, is it? Which is, of course, the Indian spring. I'm just looking out the window there and wondering about that. It's interesting because you look that way, look out the window, and you think, you see the rain, you see the cold. Okay, well, that's India, not here. However, you look this way, and you see that the deities are dressed in yellow today. This would be the tradition in India for the deities to be in yellow. Reflects, of course, the mustard fields in spring, and of course, it's also time for where some grains are harvested as well in India. So the colours of spring, so despite the fact that it's still January and we're in a UK cold, dark winter, a rainy one as well, nevertheless we can be warmed up by the sun-like deities there on the altar. They help us, you can just feel the warmth just by looking at them actually. That's confirmation by the Lord. So a little bit about Raghunath Das Goswami. I've only got a few minutes. We'll probably have a few questions as well, so I'll just be brief, if you forgive me. Raghunath Das Goswami, he was born in 1495, and he, of course, was obviously one of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. And among the six, compared to the others, he was renowned for his qualities of simplicity and renunciation, in particular, simplicity and renunciation. Although he was born in a dynasty of Vaishnavas, he was the only son of a very wealthy landowner. That's Govardhan Das, who was actually from South Bengal. But even though he was a family of Vaishnavas, his father was an opulent man, and naturally, as a lot of fathers would do, look, I've had this big business house for you. But was he interested? No. He just wanted to become a renunciate. So, of course, they tried to stop him from escaping from home and living in the forest or running off to Lord Chaitanya. They tried all different kinds of ways of keeping him at home. Even putting bars on his window. However, of course, he found a way to escape, and eventually he made a journey to Jagannath Puri. There, at 15 years old, so he was only a very young boy, of course, so he was a rebellious teenager, it would seem, a transcendental teenager. And so in Jagannapur, he let Lord Chaitanya, and by the mercy of Lord Nityananda, he renounced a beautiful wife and his opulent family. He ran to Jagannath Puri to intimately serve. Lord Gauranga gave his personal Govindan Sheila to him. Interesting. Raghunath Das led a life of extreme devotional practice, spending more than 22 hours a day chanting Hare Krishna. Wow. That really puts us to shame, doesn't it? I could lucky if I do half an hour. Yeah. Of course, during his time, he wrote over 30 different works, poems and books and so forth, and treaties. In the Jiva Dharma of Raghunath Das Goswami, Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote, he showed the esoteric method of engaging oneself in the loving service of Radha Krishna. Raghunath Das wrote and taught that the divine service of Srimati Radharani is the topmost spiritual perfection. For this he is known as the Prarojana Acharya, the teacher who reveals the highest fulfillment in life. So therefore, we remember the appearance day of such an exalted personality, one of the six Goswamis. Also, I touch on the disappearance of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. He was born in, it's his disappearance day, so he passed away in, according to what they calculate, has been about 1708, and he was born in 1626. So a few generations after the Raghunath Das Goswami. He wrote 17 books, of course, and he, while staying in Krishnadas Kaviraj's Bhajan Kirtir at Radhakund, he was writing and chanting Hare Krishna and so forth. So that was him. So again, he was, I think, fourth in line after Narottam Das Thakur. So he was a great author and so forth. So I'll end there and ask for your forgiveness and prayers. And if everyone has any questions or corrections,